Very happy to have you here this afternoon in this beautiful lingering day of July 1992. And especially then, I want to say that Peter Strawn is going to share with us some of his ideas from his experiences at Camp Kewaunee. And why don't we start out with a little bit about how you first heard about Camp Kewaunee, Peter?
All right. There were two sources. My parents lived in Tenafly, New Jersey in the 30s, and they were acquainted with Raymond and Franny. So they must have heard about Camp Kewaunee through them. Mm-hmm. And my late aunt used to come up here every summer. She came for some 20 years. And stayed at the log cabin across the street, next to Pine Lodge, when Pine Lodge was standing. And she was a school teacher and principal, and she also did a very great deal of creative writing. She was a poet, short story writer, an attempted novelist, and she used to come and do her writing in the privacy of the log cabin. She had her meals at the inn, of course. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. She was a very close friend of the Myers and of George Frank.
Mm. Wonderful. So you really kind of felt as if you belonged here from the very beginning. Well, then what year now was your first year here?
Well, my entire family came here to visit the inn mm-hmm. in 1939. Mm-hmm. It was the only time that my parents, my two brothers, and I ever went on a vacation together, and we stayed in what's now Cabin 3. It was then called Cabin 2.
Mm-hmm. So then you got acquainted, you went down to the camp and saw it in operation.
Camp was closed at that point. We came after the camp had closed.
I see. So then, was it the following year then that you came as a camper, or was
it a little
bit later?
The following year, we had some family problems. We were moving from Tenafly to Pittsburgh. The original plan was to send me to the camp that year, but 1940 turned out to be impossible. Mm-hmm. My first year was 1941.
Mm-hmm. And what age and would you have been at that time?
I was 10.
You were 10, and cabin?
Panther Lodge.
Panther Lodge.
And every camper was new that year.
Every camper. Well, that's interesting.
The counselors, two fellows named Ralph Lucas and Dave Tilton, had their hands full, believe me. Mm-hmm.
Do you remember much about Ralph or Dave as far as whether they were from the east or west, whether they were college
age? They were both from Columbus, I believe. Uh-huh.
And whether it was he a teacher? Was Ralph a teacher, or was he more apt to have been, say, still going to college?
I think he was probably still going to college.
Uh huh. That's interesting.
I understand from Bill Yardley that he's a lawyer and is still practicing in Columbus.
Oh, I see. Uh huh.
And Dave Tilton is also still alive. I'm not quite sure what he's doing.
Mm-hmm. Well, who else was in your cabin that in your lodge that
T.D. Riley?
Oh yes. I saw T.D. up here, you know, about 5 years ago, and ran across him in another setting at around Ohio State.
His father was a camper here, you know.
Yes, I interviewed him up in the lodge during our reunion, you know, a number of years ago now. Who else?
Jay Hanna, and his cousin Chuck Pace, Eddie Goodhart, mm-hmm. Peter Sutro. And later on in the season, a boy named John Toothaker from Wilton, who had terrible jokes made about his name.
you remember more. I know, you know, we hadn't exactly planned this, so your memory is excellent. Asking other individuals from time to time on their cabins, you know, their lodge mates, they often can't come forth. Well, then, did you continue coming each year then following 41?
I was a camper in 42, 43, and 44. Mm-hmm. And in 45, I was a kitchen boy.
Mm-hmm. Well, you see, our paths began to cross then in 44 and 45. So that's how we first got to know each other.
That's the year you did If Men Played Cards as Women Do.
That's right. Frank Harrow was one of the other players. I don't recall myself.
You brought an electric razor.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
I was in a play that year, too, but I can't remember what the name of it was, except that mm-hmm. I had just been in Shakespeare's play, The Tempest, and I was all full of the theater. Mm-hmm. And Maurice Allgaier asked me if I would like to be in a little skit.
Right.
I was the good boy, don't ask me why. Bobby Kitchell was the brat. Webby Davis was the mother. Mm-hmm. And Gordon Willard was the reverend.
Oh, yes. Gordon Willard, yes. Gordon Willard and Henry Blau kept in contact with each other over the years. I know that Gordon was with Polaroid and Union Carbide. I think he may either be still or have recently retired from Union Carbide there in Danbury, Connecticut. Well, what was your favorite activity as you went through the various years, and maybe some of the counselors that had most influence on you?
Well, as an activity, I particularly liked boating. Mm-hmm. I wasn't allowed to do very much because I couldn't swim when I came here.
Oh.
But I always enjoyed boating, canoeing, going across the lake, going down to the Narrows. That was always one of my favorite things to do.
So, Mr. Nickerson was in charge of that?
That was later on. The first year I came here, there was an Australian fellow named Keith Thwaites.
Oh.
Thwaites, who had wonderful stories to tell about Australia and New Zealand, and he used to put on one-man shows and show slides.
Terrific. Do you recall how he was interested in coming to
the
camp?
No idea. That was the only year he was here, I believe.
Just the 1 year, again, 41 now
41.
We're thinking of.
That's right.
Uh-huh.
He was senior counselor in the Pine Tree Lodge.
I see. Oh, that's interesting. What about some of the other activities or counselors that you seem to be most impressed with, or perhaps some of any stories about either your experiences or others that you think might add to the information we want to gather?
Well, I enjoyed nature a great deal. Nature was run in 1941 and 42 also by Mr. and Mrs. Goodwin from Columbus. I don't know their first names, and I was waiting for a mention of them on the tape interviewing GR. I was
right.
Sort of waiting for their names to come up. I believe they're still alive.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody told me that they were living in a section of Columbus that had become less good than it used to be, and they were not doing too well.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure they were teachers, but that's about all I can tell you about.
Remember them.
By 1942, they were joined by Art Kiefer.
Oh, Art came.
Who sort of shared the responsibility for the nature department with them.
I see.
I enjoyed that. I enjoyed going on mineral trips, and I particularly enjoyed knowing the man who was in charge of trips, Bates.
Oh, yes.
One of the finest men I ever met.
Right. So then, the programs that we have discussed earlier, such as Stunt Night or Play Night, and the role that Ross Miller had, or Chief Marshall, these are all our names, of course, that you got to know and are familiar with. Are there any other counselors or campers? Perhaps there were some older boys in your younger years, or other experiences that you had with other campers that you would like to share?
Well, I can tell you about one other counselor whom I liked very much and was quite dependent on for a while. That was Noel Piercy, who ran the shop, and who had warned all of us never to stand next to the bandsaw on the side. We were always to be in front or in back, but never on the side.
Right.
I stood on the side. Just the day there happened to be a nail in the wood.
Oh,
and it broke, left a mark on me here that I still have to this very day. I was
a
mess. Mm-hmm. And Noah Piercy carried me up to the infirmary, and Dr. Defoe was called from Dixfield to patch me up.
Yeah.
No damage was done. It was just a scare.
I don't think anybody has mentioned Dr. Defoe yet on any of the tapes, and yet I too remember him coming to camp and the commitment he had in being here, and of course then later on his young son, Gardner, at about age of six. I don't know exactly.
Who caught the fish that was bigger than he was.
That's right, and he was in the catalog for many years after that, wasn't he, with that fish. What would you say then was your experience as a kitchen boy? I think
we're skipping ahead then to 1945.
Yeah, if you'd like to, unless there's something else you want to bring up in there.
But well, I'd like to mention one of my boyhood heroes, Bill Myers.
All right.
Who really kind of took me under his wing and was very, very good to me, particularly after I was injured and had to live in the infirmary for a while. He used to come and see me, and when I was able to get around again, he used to carry me on his shoulders and was kind of like a big brother.
He was a counselor at that time?
He was a counselor in the Lynx Lodge.
Now, were you in that lodge that year?
This is 1941. I was in the Panther Lodge.
You're a Panther. Now, what about, let's say, 42? We really want to pin that down. 42, what
42,
lodge
I was
you
in the Polecat Lodge.
You were in the Polecat.
With the counselors were Phil Drake and Dick Goss.
Oh, yes, Dick Goss. I knew Dick from Bexley, and the name Drake has come up more than once. Do you know much about Phil Drake? Was he from the East?
I know he's dead.
Mm-hmm, you know he's dead.
And I'm quite sure he was from Columbus.
Uh-huh. Okay. Okay. Going ahead then with your next year, 43, which lodge were you in?
43, I took a big leap. I was in the Beaver Lodge.
The Beaver, uh-huh.
With a counselor named Paul Weaver. Weaver the Beaver. And Don Swift from Tenafly was the junior counselor.
Now, as you went through these last two or three years, were there additional campers that you would want to mention that you feel either continued for some length in camp or made somewhat of an impression on you?
Well, my closest friend for 3 years at camp here was a fellow named John Puccinelli. Mm-hmm. Who was called Nino, don't ask me why. Mm-hmm. I've lost touch with him. I have no idea what's become of him.
I see.
And even after the fire, nobody was able to locate him. Mm-hmm. When they sent all these mailings out in an effort to reach people who might help the camp. Mm-hmm. His name came up a blank. So did Peter Baldwin's. He was a friend of mine also.
Peter Baldwin. Uh-huh. Okay, those are interesting names, in any name of this sort, because other people hearing this tape may
have some idea.
Think about that name and maybe know more about it. Then 44, what lodge would you
44,
have been?
44, I was in the Moose Lodge with Carl Strong.
Oh, yes.
And Irving Boughton. Uh-huh, uh-huh. As counselors.
Okay. Yes, I think that's right. That's when I first knew you, you see. And I know Carl Strong had difficulty maintaining the order of that.
So he did.
Lodge.
He was quite a bit older than most of the senior counselors, I think.
And yes, he would.
And we played a number of practical jokes on him.
He opened himself up, as I remember, because I would see him going up to shave.
Oh yes.
Maybe during the time you were having preparing for inspection.
You are absolutely right. You are absolutely right.
And we
left him an anonymous letter protesting this.
That's right.
He didn't like it.
No, it was so different than working for Coach Smith, you see, in the Wildcat Lodge, as I did. And here I'd see this senior counselor going up, and, you know, I was well aware of that, even though I was only a 13-year-old kid here at the camp. Now, let's go on then with the being a kitchen. Well, here you were in somewhat the more privileged position as a camper, and now you're put into a position where you're having to perform, and a little more as a kitchen boy. At what age would that have been?
14.
14. You see, it seemed to me sometimes in looking over our campers that it was an awful lot to ask a boy who might be 16 and a master camper to give 2 hours of work effort to the camp, because he was so used to playing the role of the camper and not the counselor. And so I'm curious as to how a 14-year-old young fellow who had some privilege in being here at the camp, being put in that position, did you find that a challenge? You find it aggravating? You certainly had an opportunity to see different sides, maybe, of Emma and Lawrence, Were they...
Not Lawrence. Lawrence was still in the Army at that time.
I see.
But I did work for Emma, who was quite a disciplinarian, but a very good person. I had great respect, great affection for Emma. Still do.
Did,
That job was a disappointment to me in one very important way, because the previous year, to back up a little bit, in 1944, George Frank had asked me to help some of the younger boys write their letters home. And I used to go to the Eagle Lodge a couple of times a week and help some of the younger boys write letters. I would do the actual writing for them. I would try to put what they said into sentences. And I thought that I was being groomed for a position as a junior counselor. I guess I was mistaken. I should have asked why. I should have asked George Frank whether I could continue doing this while I was being a kitchen boy, too. Mm-hmm. But somehow I never did.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I see.
But as you say, I did regard the job as a challenge. I had been a substitute kitchen boy once or twice. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Whenever a kitchen boy wanted some time off, the only way you could get it was to have somebody else agree to take over for you. Mm-hmm. So I had filled in a couple of times in 1944 as a kitchen boy. I was simply told how to set the table, how to clear up, mm-hmm. and that I had to dry silverware.
This is an interesting, your comments are interesting because it was not, I don't know when they stopped having as many, quote, kitchen boys and having someone in each of the lodges start to do more.
Well, this was in itself a latter-day development because mm-hmm. when I came here in 1941, there were three kitchen boys.
I see.
They did everything. Of course, it was a full-time job. They didn't go to activities. And the arrangement was that they were not paid anything, but they were allowed to have some time off and to enjoy the facilities of the camp and to be on a sort of vacation for at least part of the time. It was a kind of break-even deal. They would simply come up and wait on the tables. Mm-hmm. But later on, they had many more kitchen boys, and they expected them to go to activities. They also charged them tuition.
I was also interested in some comments over the years that we've talked here at the inn about some of the other personalities that you either continued to learn more about or which who you may have known, like Morris
Morris Burgess, I knew from even before I came here. He was one of the people that Mr. Elmore looked out for and protected. As I understand it, Morris Burgess had planned on a sort of early retirement, had provided himself with a very small income and a station wagon, which he figured would last him the rest of his life, neither of which was true. And so Mr. Elmore provided him with an accounting job of some sort in the church office.
Well, I remember that sort of thing, too.
He did somewhat the same thing here.
His razor and his typewriter, he had figured out everything that was supposed to last him to the rest of his life. And having worked in the camp store, as I did with Frank Hera for the first year or two that I was here, I got to know him, and I found him to be a very compassionate and a very fine person. And so perhaps even though I was a little older, he seemed to lend an aspect to the camp that I thought was very necessary. He would always look for those boys who looked a little downhearted, were homesick. He would put his arm around them and talk with them, and he really kind of played the role of the grandfather to them, as far as I could see. And so I always thought a great deal of him.
I agree completely. He was fond of saying, there's a poor soul.
Yes.
There's a hard worker.
That's right.
In fact, Cam Scarlett began one of his logs by saying, would Kiwanee still be Kiwanee if Morse Burgess stopped saying, there's a poor soul?
Yes.
If Herbie Earth stopped saying, under his breath, I hope, after saying, I now light the central fire of the Great Spirit.
Yes, right. These are very important memories, I think, to share. Did you get to know anyone else particularly well, maybe by being a kitchen boy that who lived in the main lodge? For instance, Campbell Scarlett, of course, perhaps he was still in the Eagle Lodge in those days.
Yes, he was.
But there were others that did live in the main lodge, or didn't your contacts really ever reach up in much into
the main lodge? Well, there was a girl named Ginny from Columbus,
uh-huh,
who sort of did babysitting, I think, for Raymond and Franny. She used to be a sort of companion to Betty, and she taught me how to dance.
Oh, that was important. What about the Liggett boys? You know, they just occurred to me, I hadn't thought about them for a long time. The twins, they were kitchen boys, weren't they?
One year. 1943.
43, so that wouldn't have been the year that you... Jim and Bob, right. That's right. I don't know why that comes to my mind, but it did. Are there other counselors or campers that either you have learned to appreciate more since camp, for instance? Now, what about like Herb Brown, for instance, or Ray Brown?
I knew Herb Brown, but not very well. Just Herbert Russell Brown, I presume.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I saw him several years ago. He was here with his wife,
uh-huh,
and he was surprised that I remembered his middle name.
Of course, he was a judge and ran for the political office and had his 6 years and was expected to run again, but he wants to write. So he turned that opportunity down last November to run on the Supreme Court of Ohio. It seems to me as if there may be some others that reflected on the tradition from New Jersey. I mean, that's kind of where your background lends you to. Any stories about Raymond or about Dr. Elmore or others that you would like to share?
Well, Mr. Elmore, I have very, very fond recollections of. He had a doctorate, but he always insisted on being called Mr.
Mm-hmm.
He would correct you if you called him Dr. Elmore. Mm-hmm. No, it's Mr. Elmore. And I remember particularly, well, he always gave these wonderful sermons with his great rumbling bass voice that would rattle the window shades if he'd been indoors. And he would cite Mount Tumbledown towering over the lake and would tell stories that I think really hit home with some of the kids.
Mm-hmm.
There was one I particularly liked when he got up and made an impassioned plea for equal justice and equal rights for what he called Negroes. We would say blacks or even Afro-Americans.
But today.
He said Negroes. I've learned since then that he was one of the first clergymen in Englewood who used to exchange pulpits with the local black church every year, just as a goodwill gesture.
Mm-hmm.
And he got up and he gave an eloquent sermon about how the first man to die in the First World War was a Negro, the first man to die in the Second World War was a Negro, and went on to tell about how in certain southern cities, Negro soldiers were required to use the back door where Nazi German prisoners of war were allowed to come in through the front door, and how terrible he thought this was. Now, I was so moved by that sermon that I went to see him in his water tower where he had an office and asked him if I could copy down the sermon word for word just for my own edification, and he let me do it.
Do you remember what year that was?
That was 45.
45, mm-hmm. And I heard that too. And have been impressed. You know, he wrote that one book that we sold in the camp store of stories of different sermon topics that were very meaningful. I'm just trying to think in terms of impressions on others like Dick Miller, or of course his dad, Ross Miller, or Henry Blau, or any other individuals, Dick Stillinger or Dick Romey, any individuals in that generation in particular that you remember either as, well, I guess it'd be more campers because
Well, I remember Dick Rummy the best out of that that bunch that you've mentioned, because mm-hmm. he and I both played in the camp orchestra. Uh-huh. He played clarinet and I played saxophone.
Uh-huh.
That one year, 1945. But I keep thinking of one of my oldest friends, somebody I met at Kewaunee in 1941. In fact, I met him even before we came to Kewaunee. I was coming up on the train with the Eastern Group from New York City, and for whatever reason, the plans were not announced, but we stopped in Portland and spent the night in a hotel. We all thought we were going to arrive at camp in the middle of the night. But instead, we stayed at this hotel in Portland, I can't tell you the name. And I was in a room with Walter Barrington, the trumpet player, and Larry Miller, who was a year or two younger than I was at that time. He was in the Eagle Lodge, mm-hmm. when I was in the Panther. I met Larry Miller again several years later because he went to the gunnery school, where I went. He taught at the gunnery school.
Oh, my.
He still lives in Washington, Connecticut, and he is one of my very best friends.
Mm-hmm.
There aren't many people that I could say I've known for 51 years. That can't be.
Yeah, right. I never estimate well either, because it always sounds too much, too many years there. But that's wonderful.
His picture was in the camp catalog for years. He was one of the row of kids on the kickboards.
I see.
You probably know the photograph.
Yes, I know.
Malcolm Davis was in it. Morrow Bott was in it.
Mm-hmm.
Roger Bruce was in it.
Mm-hmm.
And Serge Lawrence Miller.
Excellent. Yes, we need not. I don't think we'll probably have time this year, but I need to review, those pictures. And I'm sure there are individuals that you could identify that I don't know, because of those three or four years that you were here before I was, and your excellent memory.
Well, thank you. I went over the 1941 group picture with, I think, Walter Estabrook last year,
mm-hmm.
and I was able to identify almost 80% of the people
That's
in
excellent.
The picture.
Mm-hmm.
So perhaps I could help.
Yes, we went over some, and I do have the list of those.
Oh, I went over with you, too.
Yes,
okay.
You went over those with me a few years ago, but I would like, now that I have a little more time and I'm retired, I would like to be sure that I have as much of the information as you have to offer in that sort of thing. Well, Peter, I don't know whether I'm sure there's a few things that maybe we have missed, but I would just again inquire as to whether there's anything else of a story nature relating, especially of course to GR or RC, that you feel might be interesting and informative about them or anyone else that might occur, any other counselors or individuals that might occur to you.
Well, I can tell you a couple of things secondhand, perhaps, that mm-hmm. Maybe you already have them on the tape of the interview with GR, but he told me a bit about his family and a bit about Raymond, particularly, which I had not known. He mentioned starting the camp together, of course, and mentioned Raymond's musical career.
Mm-hmm.
He was traveling with a group that was performing the Student Prince sometime during the early 1920s. How many years this went on, I don't know. But George did tell me that Raymond had been very much in love with somebody during mm-hmm. the First World War, and then that while Raymond was away in service, she married somebody else. And he was terribly embittered, and it looked for a while as if he would never get married. Of course, he did marry Franny in 1935.
Yes.
But they went about things very cautiously. They even separated for a year to make sure they would still want to see each other after that time. And they did.
That's interesting. Uh-huh. He was very thorough about
very
a number
thorough.
Of things. That's right. So then, in those early years of camp, then you have a feeling that he was more attracted to the singing, acting career than anything else, as far as Raymond was concerned.
I would guess that. Mm-hmm. I would guess that.
Very, very interesting.
Of course, George was also very musical. He played the piano.
Yes, that's right.
He sang quite tolerably in the quartet.
very good. Those years, was it
Raymond,
I remember
George,
very well.
The Reverend Myers and Art Kiefer, wasn't that?
That's right. Name? That's right. That particular quartet to me has never been equaled. I know it's one of those things. I guess when you're at a certain age, it really makes an impression on you. Well, is there anyone else then that you can think of, or stories again that you would want to share?
Dean Miller, perhaps.
Okay, good.
I had a very hard time learning how to swim. I was taught to swim by somebody who believed in throw them in.
Right.
If they can't swim, let them drown. I will not mention his name, but he was a counselor here in 1941.
Uh-huh.
And by 1942, I still wasn't a very good swimmer. I could barely make three laps between the docks. Mm-hmm. And I tried several times to swim the cove that year and did not make it. And finally, I was in my lodge one day, and out of nowhere appeared Dean Miller,
mm-hmm.
who said, "Come with me, Porky." That's what I was called in those days, a name I now despise, but that's what I was called.
Sure.
And he said, "We'll start out very quietly to swim the cove." Mm-hmm. And I was terrified,
sure.
having tried it and not made it. But he told nobody that we were going. We simply went out to the end of Pine Point. And he got in the boat and rowed very slowly, and I swam the cove for the first time. Wow. With his moral support.
Right. Well, having had some similar feeling towards swimming when I came here, I can identify with that very closely. And those are kind of experiences that you really, you know, you can't replicate. A little addition onto that is how I swam the cove, I think, my first or maybe second year, and by the time I was in the crow's nest, my third year, Henry Blau and some of the others were all going to take senior life-saving. And I came up and they said, "Ed, you're going to take senior life-saving too." And I said, "Gosh," I said, "I haven't swum the lake yet." And they said, "Oh, you're going to do that tomorrow, but we're going to..." And I did, you know, that was it. Stillinger rowed, and Henry Blau was the lifeguard or whatever. Sometimes you just need that little extra boost and confidence that someone else can give to you. Well, this has been a wonderful afternoon to sit down and talk, and I do appreciate your willingness to take a little bit of your time here at the inn this year to do this, Peter.
It's a pleasure. I have very fond memories of this place.
And again, we'll say this is July 30th, 1992, right? As we're sitting here discussing further ideas, people, you've come up with some rather interesting stories that I think would be good to have for posterity. And I guess you were beginning to talk about Bates and...
Bates's moral suasion, which was mm-hmm. considerable. I remember stopping by very, very briefly in 1972. I hadn't even planned to stop by, but I was staying up in Rangeley, and I passed Route 142, and I thought, "Oh, hell, I'll drive over and see who's there and say hello." The camp had closed, and I saw George and Mary very briefly, and I saw the Estabrooks. And Bates was still staying over at the main lodge with Florence, and I went and I had really a very long talk with him. And he began talking about Pearly Durgan. Mm-hmm. And I remembered that on a trip down the Kennebec River in 1945, Pearly had picked me as his bowman. This is one of the great honors, one of the great moments of my life to be chosen to do that. And Bates said, "You know, Pearly knew the Kennebec River even better than I did." He said, the first time we went camping with him out there, and I pulled the canoes, oh, about 25, 30 feet up off the bank. Pearly wasn't satisfied. He said, "No, the canoes go up there, about 50 feet further up."
Mm-hmm.
And not being willing to argue with him, I moved the canoes all the way up there. Pearly knew something that the rest of us didn't know, which is that they opened the sluice gates at Moosehead Lake, and that the Kennebec River rose that much overnight, the canoes all would have been gone in the morning if Pearlie hadn't known about that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But we went on further in our conversation. Bates mentioned Pearlie some more, and he said, you know, he's staying in a retirement home over in Gardiner, just south of Augusta. And why don't you go over and see him? And I said, well, I really don't have time on this trip, but next time I come up, I will certainly stop in and see him. Can you, if you'll tell me where it is? And Bates said, I think you should go today.
Uh-oh.
He said, take some fresh fruit. He likes that. He's just staying there in a room with Rosie, his wife, and he doesn't get to see people very much. And I think you should go today. It isn't very far out of your way. I think you should go today.
And so you did.
But yes, I went today, that day, and I did find the place fairly easily. And the people didn't give me the creeps as I expected they would. It didn't look like the usual home for the aged. It was a very pleasant, very humane place. And I found Pearlie, who didn't recognize me at all, but he immediately said, where's Bates? Did you bring Bates with you?
Quite an impression. Now,
I was glad I did that, because Pearlie died a couple of months later. I never would have seen him again.
Bates probably maybe had that feeling.
I was glad that Bates pushed me.
Yeah, right. Now, what a little bit about background on Pearlie. Do you know much about the background on how he got involved with the camp?
Not really, except that his name was very well known around here. I used to go visiting around Moosehead Lake and further north, up toward Mount Katahdin, and at a number of stores that I stopped in, people knew his name. Mm-hmm. He was a household word.
So he was able to assist outdoorsmen.
Oh, absolutely. He used to drive the bouncing buggy faster than Bates did.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Going up the long, steep driveway with the canoes in tow.
Right. That was that exit from the camp up to the road. Well, something else you brought up a little earlier that I thought might be interesting to bring out. I don't know. Was there some other story that you wanted to add on here now besides experience?
I've forgotten what it was.
In talking about the inn here and how the inn became associated with the camp program, you were mentioning some insights that you had, Peter, on the purchase of the land from the Deckers and the arrangements that were to be made on Pine Lodge across the street. Would you explain that to me?
Well, my understanding is that when the land became available here and George Frank decided to build the inn, he bought the land from Mrs. Decker, who also owned Pine Lodge, used to be across the street,
right,
next to the log cabin, which is still there and which is now called Pine Lodge, I believe.
Yes.
And she was concerned because an old inn couldn't very well compete against a new one right across the street. And so she agreed to sell the Franks this land, where the inn is, if they would agree to purchase Pine Lodge too, which they did.
Mm-hmm. I see.
And that was used for quite a while. They had the overflow of guests, and I guess they had some staff people living over there.
Yes. Yes, there's still some use of it by Marty, I think, and so forth. But then
that's the log cabin.
That's the log cabin.
Yeah, but Pine Lodge itself is gone.
Yes. What did it burn or was it torn down?
I think it began to collapse of its own weight, and they finally knocked it down. It was an old yellow building. I've got a picture of it somewhere.
I remember it too, back even I think in the 60s and 70s.
Oh,
I
yes.
think. I don't know exactly when that was torn down, but only the log cabin is left. But now you were also commenting on having seen some plans of GR that showed where the inn was to be down closer to the camp, but due to financial costs and so forth, that GR wasn't able to.
Yes, they were not able to buy the land along what we call the inn beach now.
Uh-huh.
Although they did acquire the right of way, they still have the legal right to cross the beach, but that's all they were able to afford.
Uh-huh.
My understanding is that for one of $10,000, they were not able to buy that land.
Right.
Yes, I have seen a drawing. I can't tell you exactly when it was made, but it shows the camp pretty much as we recognize it, with the main lodge, three cabins on each side, the rec hall, and then just the other side of Pine Point is an inn.
Uh-huh.
Floor plan for an inn.
Right.
Diagram for an inn.
Well, that would make a lot of sense, of course.
To have it right next door.
Opportunity was still available, but that land had been purchased by others by the time GR was prepared and able to move on with this idea. The year 1932 comes to my mind as...
Well, the inn was built in 29.
The inn was built in 29. I see. Okay.
It has to be, because the very first guest register shows June 1st, 1930, F.W. Frank.
Mm-hmm.
First person to appear on the scene.
Mm-hmm. Good.
So it must have just been built the summer before.
Summer before. And then these three cabins down here along the lake were built, I believe, in the 40s, because I remember...
Well, later than that, I think.
Might even
later
be in the 50s. It was before I stopped coming in 1950, though, mm-hmm. come to think of it.
Because when I was here in 1945, these
were
not
here. So somewhere between 45 and 50, then, they must have...
And the ones on top of the knoll, I believe, were built around 1936.
I see.
That's just a guess, but...
Uh-huh.
Because originally... George and Florence used to stay in that room at the back that overlooks the driveway.
Oh, I see. That's where they used
double room.
Uh-huh.
That was their quarters.
I see. Well, that's interesting also. Well, thank you.
For what it's worth, the first time I visited here in 1939, mm-hmm. when I was staying at the inn, Ma Frank's cabin had just been built.
Oh, that's interesting.
There used to be a tent on the site there. Ma, I believe, lived in the main lodge,
mm-hmm.
but she used to come down and sort of hold court in this tent, which was where the cabin is now.
Uh-huh.
I've seen pictures of it.
I see.
And the campers and counselors would come by and visit with her.
Mm-hmm.
And I would presume that she was getting on in years and was not able to move around so easily, and so they decided to build a cabin for her on this very spot.
I see. Uh-huh. Well, what was it, by 45 or 46 she had died, wasn't it? And they were beginning to look for funding for the new nature building. It was more or less to kind of commemorate
her. A memorial to her, right.
Yes. So...
Because I'm not sure when she died, but she was here in 1945.
Yes, yes. So maybe it was just that...
46 or 47, I would say. Uh-huh. It was around that time.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And she lived to be 95, I think.
And you mentioned to me a little bit more about... her background in Westbrook, about having run a store.
Yes, I understand that she ran a clothing store, and that she raised George and Raymond.
And
she and Pop were separated.
And her full name again was?
Abby Conant Frank.
Abby Conant Frank. I'd like to do a little more research, you see, in that area, too.
Henry Blau might be able to tell you, because he's found some keepsakes with her name on it in the house.
I see. Uh-huh. Very good. And we aren't sure what the occupation of their father was.
I'm not sure.
I thought it was insurance. And you also suggested that they were separated at some point after the boys were born.
Yes, quite early, I would say, because Ma definitely raised them.
I see. And yet,
she used to send Raymond up to a camp or something upstate. She would put him on the train, and there would be a tag around his neck saying, "My name is Raymond Frank, and I live in Westbrook," just in case he got lost.
In case he got lost. Well, thank you, Peter, for a very informative afternoon here. And this is Ed Hamblin signing off for now. The...